I'm CC Lucas. I'm a Dartmouth College junior. I'm in the class of 2021, and I'm in my home right now in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm interviewing Hale Irwin, who's a 68. And Hale, where are you right now?
Middlesex, Vermont.
Middlesex, Vermont. And we are conducting this interview in the morning on June 11th, 2020, for the Dartmouth Vietnam Project. Thank you so much for doing this interview and just agreeing to talk with me today. So can I ask you where and when you were born, just to start off the interview?
I was born in Baltimore in December 28, 1945, while my mother was living at Edgewood Arsenal and my father was overseas in World War II.
Where was your father overseas?
Oh, I'm not sure at that time. He I'm not clear of all of his goings on during the war.
And can you tell me your parents' names or if you had any other members of your family?
Yeah, my father was Henry Franklin Irwin. They called him Frank. My mother was Josephine Irwin. And I have an older brother named, we call him Terry, and I have a younger sister named Maud.
And so did you live with your older brother and your younger sister and your mother for the majority?
My father was ended up after the war in the State Department, so the family moved around the world in different places, like London, Edinburgh, Scotland, Tegucigalpa, Honduras, and Costa Rica. And then my father was at the United Nations when my family was living in Washington, D.C. So I went away to boarding school in ninth grade. I went to a Quaker boarding school in Pennsylvania. And the school is named Westtown School.
So before you went to Westtown in Pennsylvania, do you have any memories of the places you lived abroad?
Yes, I do. Honduras was probably the most the place that made the most difference in my life, because I saw the poverty and the families, the great families of these people in Honduras. I like that. It was an interesting place. We were there during some revolutions and things like that, but it was quite an experience for a kid who was, 8 years old?
Yeah, really young. What do you mean by you liked the families?
I just like the Latino families. There's something about them. They're very close. They love their children. I just noticed that, and I still notice it today.
So you moved to Pennsylvania with your old family. You moved to Pennsylvania to attend boarding school. And do you know what year you started boarding school?
1960, I guess, because I graduated in 64. My parents were in Costa Rica with my younger sister at that time, and my older brother was in college.
Where did he go to college?
Wesleyan, Connecticut.
Oh, okay. So you were pretty much on your own, as is sort of how it goes with boarding school a lot of the time. Was that the first time it was like that for you in your life?
Say again?
Was that the first time that you were pretty much on your own, apart from your family?
Yes, and basically that was the last time we were together as a family, really. I mean, sure, I'd see them on vacations or while I was on leave and things like that, but my mom sort of ended up losing their kids to boarding schools, at least their boys, when they were ninth grade age.
And why did you want to go to Westtown? Was that sort of a decision that you made?
No. It was a decision that they made. My brother went there first, and I think the reason we went there was because my mother grew up in Paoli, Pennsylvania, and she knew the area, she knew the school, and because we're in Costa Rica, there was no real school for me to go to, so they decided to send me there. And it was one of the best experiences. I mean, it was, to me, it meant much more than Dartmouth. You know, I mean, I have much closer friends from Westtown. I have, I think the values of the Quakers at Westtown helped mold me to be the person I am today.
How so? What was your experience like there?
Well, the Quakers are pacifists. Well, and you know, not all the kids were Quakers or anything like that, but, we used to go to Quaker meeting twice a week, and I learned the values of the value of human life and the pacifist theory or belief, which even when I was I ended up in the Marine Corps, which seems a little bit strange, but that helped me with some of my decisions. Like I didn't want to be a fighter pilot. I wanted to be a helicopter pilot so I could rescue people and help people, among other things. But so I think it was a very important to my values.
Do you think that otherwise you might have become a fighter pilot or otherwise been involved in combat?
No, I wouldn't have, but... Because I didn't have the flight grades in flight school to get to go to jets. Because at that time, when I was in the Marine Corps going through flight training, the Marine Corps was really in need of helicopter pilots for Vietnam. And so only like two out of a class of 50 would get to choose to go to jets. And so even if I'd wanted to, I wouldn't have.
Statistically. Okay, I want to ask a little bit more about your experience in Westtown, because that was ultimately, did you have any experiences there that academically or personally made you either want to go to Dartmouth or just like experiences that you can recall that were really significant?
Okay. Westtown is a co-ed school, so it's not like Dartmouth was when I was there.
Yeah.
Dartmouth was not co-ed. So it was nice because we all developed relationships with the opposite sex. You know, we had girlfriends girls had boyfriends and stuff. And, it was such an ideal place. Let me see. And one of the other things about Westtown was it had a farm, a dairy farm. And because my parents were out of the country, I ended up living with the farmer who was only, 8 years, 9 years older than me and his wife. And I worked on the farm for the summers while I was in high school. So I came very close to them, and I became very close to farming. I mean, I loved it. I mean, sometimes I wish I could have, you know, farmed like that, but those types of farms are all gone now. Family farms are all now big factory farms. So, but let's see what else. I don't know. Got a question?
Well, and so that dairy farm, it was owned by the Walter family. Is that right? So Dave and Cindy Walter. And
wow.
They have a son named Pete. So you, during the summers, you sort of lived with them and just spent a lot of time with that family, right?
I did. I spent more time with them. I lived there. I lived up in the attic in a nice little room up there with the family. And I'd get up in the morning at 5 o'clock, help milk the cows. And then we'd go in and the whole family would be there. Have the best breakfast you've ever had for about an hour, and then go back to out to work for the rest of the day. And in the summer, a lot of times we work till like 9 o'clock at night baling hay. So I work, and then I end up going out fooling around with my buddies from school nearby, and go get to bed around 11, get up again at 4:30 to milk the cows. But and I've kept in touch with them. I mean, I had it until very recently. They moved because they didn't own the farm. The school owned the farm. They was managing it. And they moved out to Oklahoma and brought their herd from a place, built their herd up out there. And then all of a sudden all their cows started to miscarry, their dog died, birds began to die. And it turned out they got a load of feed from the grain store that had PCB in it. It wiped out his herd, almost killed his family. So they ended up having to start all over again.
So did they get a new, they started a new, did they get a new herd?
Or they had to build up the herd, but I think they could get their herd, they had to take their herd away and put it on another land. And the land couldn't be used for like a year and a half because of the PCB and the manure and the ground and all. So it was very, very amazing. They were like family. My father commented later that about I had friends, other people's fathers, and people like Dave and stuff that he said, you know, these were your father figures because I wasn't around to do what I, you know, be a father because of a lot of the work he was doing.
And he said that to you?
Yeah, right.
Do you feel like that's true? Because he was busy with his various jobs.
Say again?
Do you feel like that's true? Like in your experience, did you feel like...
I think probably because I mean, my dad was so involved in the work at the State Department and whatever else he was doing that sometimes it was, you know, if he was worried about the Bay of Pigs invasion or something like that, he probably wasn't thinking that much about what I was doing at that moment, you know. He had a lot of going on, interesting experiences, that I think I understood. And I think what I did gain from him is a total belief in service to others. Like that's why the military, that's why I ended up doing jobs that they weren't that great, but I mean, they weren't jobs. I didn't go work for some company just to make a ton of money. I did things which I think were of value to people, hopefully.
And you think that was, did you pick up on that by watching him, or was it sort of passed on to you, that value?
Just passed on. I've thought about that. I've talked about it with my wife, Susan. I think it's just there. I mean, I don't ever remember him sitting down telling me this or that or about values and service and stuff like that. It was just the way my parents were. And I think that that's the way a lot of parents of my age were.
So some of your friends at Westtown then, if you got to know their families, do they have similar values or, you know, parents who also believed in service?
I don't think I really got to know any parents from my really well of any of my Westtown friends, because we were in a boarding school and I was, you know,
yeah,
I didn't meet their parents.
Yeah.
But I think that's why I joined the Marine Corps, because that's what you did then. You did something. People either, kids got out of college and they were going to go to the Peace Corps, they were going to go to VISTA, they're going to go in the military, regardless of a war. Because I ended up signing up for the Marine Corps, I think it was my birthday in 1964. I think it was my senior year in high school. We were home. My parents lived in Washington, and I was home. And I went to the officer selection office and took the test and signed up for that Marine PLC program that you do in the two summers while you're in college. And then when you graduate from college, you're commissioned as a second lieutenant. Well, I joined up in 64. And I hadn't even heard of Vietnam.
In high school, you hadn't?
No. Hmm. And by the time I graduated from Dartmouth and knew I was off to the, I was going in the Marine on active duty, that was it. The whole world was about Vietnam.
Yeah, and a lot of different things that people were doing after graduation were entirely tied to Vietnam.
Yeah. And a lot of the experiences at Dartmouth were tied to Vietnam protests and all that, because the school was complete, sort of divided. It was ridiculous. Like, you're either pro-war or against the war. You couldn't be rational. It was very difficult. And
Well,
I don't know if anybody's told you about every day, not every day, I think it was every Wednesday, a line of people would stand on the green. They form a line, and the guy at the first side of the line had a big blue sign that said peace, and people would stand beside him, and, you know, all up out along the paths on the green, if they were against the war. You may have seen pictures of that.
Yes. And at first, it's my understanding that it was just people who were against the war lining up. And in the coming years, people would line up, correct me if I'm mistaken about this, people would line up on opposing sides of the green if they were for the war.
For the war. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask you more about that. And about Dartmouth in general. Like, I have so many things that that we should talk about. But just to set the scene a little bit, so you started college at Dartmouth in 64, right?
I guess so. Yes. It would be summer of fall of 64, and so because I graduated in 68. Yes. And I applied to two colleges because I really wasn't that excited about where I went. While I was at Westtown, I tried to get into the Naval Academy. I took all the tests to get into the Naval Academy, but I didn't get an appointment from a, you know, a senator you needed, because I really didn't have a senator because my parents were living out of the country. So I ended up not going there. So I ended up applying to Wesleyan because I'd been there to visit my brother, and I applied to Dartmouth because my dad went to Dartmouth and I knew it meant a lot to him, and I didn't really care. So I ended up going to Dartmouth. It wasn't any great academic decision. It was just, I liked Dartmouth because it was out in the country. I mean, you know, and Hanover was a much different town back then.
Yeah, what was your impression of it, the town and the college before you went?
It was more like a smaller town, with the college being the main part of the town, and the town was much, well, today it's so, I don't know how you say it, it's so commercially yuppie. I mean, it's all these fancy stores and all this. Then it was like, you know, there was Campions, which you could get clothes, you could get skis. There was a co-op, which was really cool because they had all sorts of camping gear, skis and all that. And there was the Village Store on Allen Street. I worked there, I delivered kegs for the Village Store to the fraternities. That was my job while I was in college. But it was just a low key. It was a nice place then. I liked it. And then I ended up going back and working there later on in my life at the hospital, and the town changed and changed more and more.
So do you have any memories of your arrival at Dartmouth in 1964 in the fall? Or that term?
Yeah, I remember, the freshman trip was the best thing. I remember going with my dad, dropping me off. He and I bought myself a backpack, and then I went on one of the freshman trips, you know, at Mount Moose Lock, and it was 3 days. It was really great. And then even better, the next year I was a leader of one of the trips, and that was really fun. I really enjoyed that. But so there was the freshman trip, and then you came back to the school, and you had to wear the freshman beanies. Have you seen those?
Yeah. Do you want to just explain those quickly? Yeah.
Well, it's like a sailor hat. It was the hat part was green, and the part around the hat was white and had a 68 number on the front. And we had to wear our beanies all the time. And any upperclassman who saw you or needed something done, they'd just say, "Hey, come here." And you'd have to go help them move furniture into their rooms and clean their rooms and do all sorts of stuff. I've forgotten all about that. So it was kind of neat, actually, because it was the way you met upperclassmen. And I remember it all being pretty nice. I don't remember it as anything negatively hazing or anything like that. So then classes started within a week, I guess. And I lived in Guile Hall, room 405.
Me too. I lived in 105.
Really?
Yeah.
And you know what? Really? Huh. What was a little interesting, my father said, "I lived in that room." He lived in 405. I mean, and that was completely coincidental. I mean, it was completely coincidental. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yep. And, you know, it was a crazy place. And water fights and all that sort of thing. It was pretty immature. It was a bunch of kids, boys. I think it's a lot different now. I hope it is.
Go ahead.
No, I you go ahead.
How did you spend your time on campus, and what did you end up studying, sort of more like the 4 or so years that you were there? What were those like more broadly?
Okay, I ended up I decided to be a Spanish major because I already spoke Spanish, so I could exempt all the language requirements. So I did the literature and that sort of part of it. And the reason I did that was at that point, I was pretty idealistic and I wanted to become like my dad in the State Department. So I could take lots of government courses and courses that would be good for that. But by the time I graduated and was after my time in the Marine Corps, I didn't have much interest in being in the State Department anymore. But, so I took Spanish literature and some really great professors. Bob Russell was my favorite, Spanish professor. I hope he's still living in Hanover. I went down to his retirement it was probably 10 years ago. He had a little retirement tea and I went said goodbye to wish him well. Just a super person. I had some personal issue that I was really upset about and he invited me to come, but I don't think I did, but he invited me to come out and spend a weekend with he and his wife to get away from Hanover at the time. Just a good person, Robert Russell. And while I'm on it, other professors I really remember was Vince Starzinger, government professor. You may have heard of him. He would, 8 o'clock class, he'd stand up in his three-piece blue suit with a 12-inch cigar and give you a lecture that you could not, it was just awe-inspiring. And then I had an English professor, a literature teacher, Professor Schultz, and he was cool. And one of the first couple times he had a student like go out in the woods at night for 2 hours in the woods and then come home and write about it. And he did a couple assignments like that, which were very, really interesting and kind of fun.
That's funny that that's an experience you had in the English course. I major in English and have a professor who gives similar assignments for his nonfiction classes. They're to go into the woods or go into the cemetery and observe and then, leave and write about the experience. So, there's something very magical about that kind of teaching at Dartmouth, and it's interesting that it existed for you as well.
Yes, yeah. So I got to say, actually talking to you a little bit, I remember a lot of good things about Dartmouth, but I think what happened was the war destroyed it. It tainted all the fun, joy, and a lot of the other positive things from the school. So when I remember it, some of the good things haven't popped up because of that.
What do you want to talk about Dartmouth in terms of Vietnam? You're talking about the gatherings on the green every Wednesday. I imagine that it was a complex relationship between the students and the two sides they took and the school. Do you have any other memories or impressions of the school and how it, as you said, destroyed the fun or tainted it?
Well, there was also the racial issues going on at that time in 68. So George Wallace from Alabama.
Oh, yeah, the governor.
He ran for president. And he ended up getting shot, not killed. But he came to Dartmouth, and I went to his talk, which was in Webster Hall. Is it still Webster Hall, the sort of a hall next to the library, to the right side of the library, looking at Baker from the front. That was like a small theater play area, and he spoke there. But all he did was tell jokes about Harvard and dinging Harvard and making jokes. So he ended up leaving Dartmouth with a sort of a press saying, George Wallace has great acceptance at the Dart College. You know, kids are laughing, people are listening to him and all that. But as he left, he was getting into his car. He had a limo with a state trooper drivers and a bunch of people stopped the car and were pounding on it and pretending they were going to roll it over, try to roll it over and things like that, till the New Hampshire State Police came and cleared out the mob of college kids, and he got away. And then a couple weeks later, Malcolm X spoke. So it was quite an interesting time. And
did you feel like, oh, go on.
No, I think you probably have a better question.
Oh, no, not necessarily. I was just wondering about I want to hear what you have to say. My questions aren't, they're not necessary.
Well, everything was, it was so much of that. And I think you were so inundated with it. And I'm probably not the most academic or intellectual type person, so I probably didn't spend hours contemplating what this meant and what that meant at the time. It was sort of just life day on and day out of working towards graduating. And really, you asked me what I did at Dartmouth. I studied. I had to study hours to get my gentleman C. I mean, I lived in Baker Library up in the tower room?
The tower room. Still there? Yeah. It's in the
garden. With the big armchairs looking out the window. I had my armchair there, and I had a board, which I think was from a shelf in the library. I put it across the two arms of the chair, and that's where I studied. Probably 8 hours a day when I wasn't in class. Because if I wasn't in class, I ran cross country for my freshman team, and so I was either running cross country or studying or eating. let's see. I ended up joining a fraternity in my sophomore year, which meant nothing to me. It ended up being a place for me to live free because I became the treasurer, and I got free board, room, working at it because I was the treasurer of the fraternity. But fraternity was another thing that really, I'm not sure why I joined it. Because all my best friends were in different fraternities. We all ended up in different fraternities.
Yeah, what was, first of all, which fraternity at Dartmouth did you join?
It was Zeta Psi.
Yes, we still have Zeta Psi.
Pardon?
We still have Zeta Psi, and the house is on Webster, correct?
Right, next to Beta.
Yeah. So you just...
No, is it...
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I can't remember what the name of the other fraternity was. I get mixed up. So, let's see, that's it. I studied. I delivered kegs on fraternity meeting nights on Wednesdays and on Saturday nights. And
did you deliver them by? Did you carry them, or did you use a car or something like that?
Well, they had a pickup truck, so you go around, okay. And then you have to carry them out of the truck down into the basement, and then you tap the keg for them and go. That really was popular, though. It was amazing. You walk into a fraternity house with a keg of beer on your back, and wow, they cheer for you and everything.
You're a hero.
Pardon?
A weak hero. Just, yeah, I imagine that you would be, like, welcomed as a hero if you walked in with a keg. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and you also, while you were at Dartmouth before you away from it, you studied abroad in Spain for your major.
Yes, I did, in Salamanca, Spain. We were there at the University of Salamanca, but most of our courses were taught by Dartmouth professors. And most of us, we wrote a thesis, you know, a paper in Spanish, a long thesis in Spanish while we were there. Our professor there was Arturo Madrid, and he and his wife were like our caretakers where we're there. And we all lived in different houses, you know, with different families. And it was pretty interesting because the different type of houses or families you might live with were so different. I lived in with this old gentleman who was a dentist and his wife. And I got there late the first day, and I go into the dining room for dinner, and these two nice-looking girls there. Wow. And they ended up from Mary Baldwin, and they had another room in the apartment. So these people were making money by having students live with them. It was interesting. It was nice. I like Spain a lot. But I had another friend who, and this house had normal heat and everything. I had another guy who had to write his thesis sitting in the dining room of the house he was living in, or the apartment he was living in. And what they had was, what they called them braseros. It was like a charcoal pot of charcoal burning under their, they put it under their dining room table, and then they'd have a big heavy tablecloth you'd put over your legs and stuff so it would keep you warm. And he ended up writing his paper sitting at that table with that tablecloth up over his shoulders to keep warm.
Pretty funny. Good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So I, we got 2 weeks off vacation or leave time, vacation off while we were there, and you could do what you want with it. And some guys, most people paired up and went off. I went up off by myself because I thought I'd learn more and see more. So I took trains and, I went from Salamanca to Madrid and then down through Sevilla and Cordoba and southern Spain. And living on no money, staying in some pretty interesting or not classy pensiones. let's see.
So how did that experience while you were there, did you feel like you were connected to what was going on at all in the United States or at Dartmouth or since Vietnam?
Wow. I don't think I don't recall. I don't recall any connection. No.
Yeah.
I know the people who went to France had a hard time because the French people gave the American kids a lot of grief about Vietnam. even though they're the ones who got us involved in it. But in Spain, say again.
No, go ahead.
So in Spain, it was very much like, I think, an escape from the Vietnam thing for me, maybe. I don't recall any connection of the two.
Hmm. What was it like then returning to Dartmouth as the war was progressing?
Well, I guess that's when it all was building and building, and that's when all the marches were, and I can't recall if it was any different. I just recall that I have this image of my Dartmouth experience and the polarization of the student body over the war. And but there were fun times. I remember the time when there was huge snow and there was a huge snowball fight, and it ended up that kids were lined up on both sides of the green, pelting all the cars that came through. It got so bad the state police shut the town down so cars couldn't come in. And then Dean Seymour, Dad Seymour, who recently passed away, got smart, and he led one side of the street with an attack of the other side of the street kids, and he refocused the whole snowball fight away from the cars and the people driving through town, and they just had a big snowball fight on the green. I don't think it became a tradition. It just ended that fight that was causing so much damage at that time.
Oh, just that one.
Yeah, that was just one time. Yeah. I think I read recently he passed away, and even in his story about him, not his obituary, but about somebody wrote up about him, and they mentioned that snowball fight.
So with the tension on campus, is there anything that you recall happening, outright or subtle, other than gathering on the green? Anything that, sort of you felt from how the student body was interacting with itself or with the administration?
Not really. All I remember is my graduation, which was, because by that time, by the day I went to graduation, the day before I graduated, we were all of us who were getting commissioned as officers in the military from Dartmouth were commissioned up in the Bima, up by the big tower.
On East Wheelock Street.
Yeah. It's up back behind there, and the Bima area, outdoor, and we all were commissioned then. So we were all lieutenants or ensigns in the military by that time we graduated. So we were told, do not react to any of the thing that you hear or see. Don't make a scene. So we didn't. And my friend Jamie Newton, who I was in Spain with, who I really liked, he was a valedictorian. He was a very active in the SDS, Students for Democratic Society, anti-war. He was a valedictorian, and his famous line was, and thank God we're losing the war in Vietnam. Well, we didn't boo, but I'll tell you, our parents did. My sister-in-law tells me, my dad dad was standing on his chair way in the back yelling, shame, shame. And my mother and my brother saying, Frank, sit down, sit down. And my brother's wife said, let him yell. So then that was it. Packed up, went home. My parents were living in Middlebury by then. Went home and spent the summer in Middlebury, Vermont. And I think I was working. I worked as a mechanic and a farm machinery dealer till I went off to active duty. I mean, yeah, to flight school. I went straight to flight school in, I guess it was August or September.
Of 1968, which was a big year.
Yeah.
A lot happened that year.
That was during the Tet Offensive and all that, and the war was just huge. So I went through flight school. It took me a year to get through flight school, and was sent to California, where I transitioned into the CH-46 helicopter as a pilot, which is, I don't know, the CH-46 is tandem rotor helicopter, the one with the rotors on the top, front and back. It's the smaller version. The Army and the one they use today is the CH-47, and that's a bigger, much bigger helicopter. CH-46 was built to hold about 20 troops, and but it was very underpowered and had a little problem where it would break in half in flight back then. But these little problems were all fixed, and it became the stable helicopter for the Marine Corps from 1964 when they first got them, and they retired in 2015. And I think they had about 300 of them that were built, and obviously many of them didn't survive, but and they've all been renovated and upgraded. There's a lot of them are still being used by the State Department uses them, and a lot of companies use them now, but they've all been rebuilt and upgraded. And anyway, CH-46 is the best aircraft the Marine Corps ever had.
So what was, you trained in Pensacola, Florida, and then you also trained in California. What were those experiences like? And especially given that you thought you were going to get orders to go to Vietnam, and you did get orders to go to Vietnam. What were those training experiences like?
Well, Pensacola was an amazing experience because you'd never been in an airplane before. Well, you never flown an airplane before, and so you go through a pre-flight training where they give you tests in physics, trigonometry, and something else. Anyway, I had to go to stupid study to get sharpened up on the physics and trigonometry part. That's what they call it. You go to stupid study for a week, you do these program text things, little workbook things. And by the time you get out, you know this stuff, or you would have, in college, you would have spent a term studying it. But here you can learn what you need to know in a week because it's all, jammed right at you. So, and then after that, you went out to fly a little T-34, which is like a single engine, small airplane. With a pilot and instructor sits behind the student, and after you get through that, they send you out to Whiting. They sent us out to another airfield called Whiting, where you flew the T-28, which was more like a World War II fighter airplane, big engine, big, huge propeller. Probably one of the most difficult airplanes. Oh, it's the most difficult airplane I've ever flown because it's so primitive and so powerful, everything you have to do is done manually. Where nowadays, in an airplane, you just push a button, it trims it up. And there you had to turn the dials and wheels to make their airplane stay in balanced flight as you added power and reduced power. So did basic flight in that, learned how to fly it. Then we did acrobatics in it. You had to learn to do some acrobatics. And then you did, what was it next? Oh, then we did basic instruments, so you could learn to fly instruments. So you'd be in the back seat of the in the airplane, and they have this hood thing they put over you. It would fold over you so you couldn't see outside. So you learned how to fly it by just the instruments. And then you went to navigational instruments doing that. So you learned to navigate all by instruments and fly. And I remember one time where the instructor had me shooting flying along, and he said, okay. And I was flying approach to an airfield. So I tuned in the radio system and all that. I flew down the approach as I was supposed to, and as the gauges were showing me, and he said, okay, pop the hood. And what I should have seen was a runway, but all I saw was woods. I tuned it into the wrong radio station, so I shot an approach to nowhere. And I remember when I was going off to flight school, I thought, boy, this is going to be fun. This is really going to be fun. It was not fun. First of all, the days were like you start up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and you might have to go do two flights in a Link trainer, and then you go to breakfast. Then you could go to ground school from like 8 to noon, and then you go fly 1 or 2 hour and a half flights, and then you'd have to come home and eat, and then you have to study and prepare for the same stuff for the morning. You have to prepare for the Link flights, the real flights. And the problem is you have to memorize. You have to memorize stuff. And they proved back at that time that you could memorize something cold, and the minute you got in the air, 60% of it you'd forget. So it was really challenging. And the instructors were all Marine helicopter pilots back from Vietnam, and they were flying too many flights a day, like 4 or 5 students a day, seeing the same problems, same thing, every student, every time, because they have a speech they give. Okay, now we're going to do a loop. You lower the nose, you gain airspeed, da-da-da-da, you pull back, blah, and you pull back on a stick. He explains everything you have to do. And then he'll say, this is what you're going to do, so don't do it. And he'll tell you all the mistakes people make, and then you do it, and you make all the mistakes. So they were rather impatient. And I had this one instructor, really good guy, but he was a real screamer. His name was Captain Major, and he ended up becoming Major when he got promoted. He would just yell. They would just yell. I mean, I remember I'd be on final approach and I'd be all tensed up, and he'd key the mic and he'd scream, God damn it, relax. And that really doesn't help you relax. I had another, my roommate had another instructor who was a real screamer and yelled at him all the time. And he used to bang him on the head with his kneeboard. The kneeboard's a clipboard you have strapped to your knee, with all your information you need on it and write on it. And he used to lean over to the front seat and hit my friend on the helmet with his kneeboard. So one time, my buddy, his name was Bud Grubbs, he opens the canopy, grabs the kneeboard, and throws it out of the airplane. And the instructor said, "Wow, Grubbs, you're the first student that showed me any guts." And from then on, he never harassed him anymore. But it was a scary time scary because the flying was kind of scary. I mean, you learn how to fly in formation with four aircraft, all students in them. And you're flying a couple feet from the other aircraft, all four of you. And these are guys who hadn't been in an airplane more than maybe 6 months at that time. And then the biggest event was when we carrier qualified, when we landed on the aircraft carrier, the Lexington.
Yeah, do you want to continue talking about what you're saying with your training?
Okay. The most memorable part of the training was what we called hitting the boat, which is when we carrier qualified or qualified to be take off from an aircraft carrier. We did this in the T-28, which was, as I was saying earlier, is like a World War II fighter plane, 1,800 horsepower, three-bladed prop, and the instructor or two pilots sit one behind the other. So the day we hit the boat, you practice qualifying on the ground, and you use what's called the Fresnel lens or the meatball to fly, so you know it keeps you on the glide slope, so your aircraft will touch down, hopefully, mm-hmm. at the right spot on the carrier deck, which is the number two wire. Because there's four wires across the deck or cables, and the tail hook, the hook on the back of the aircraft hangs down and can catch the airplane and stop it. So for about a month, we went to a place called Bruton Field out in Alabama, which is in the town of Bruton, Alabama. I think that's the name of the town. But it was a tiny little town, had a neat little restaurant-type bar place where we could go for lunch. But so we had to be out there by 5 o'clock in the morning because to do the carrier qual thing, you're flying very low, very slow, and wind really makes a big difference. So we'd go out there, do a flight, which would only take about 20 minutes because you get about four attempts using the mirror system, which I'll describe. And then we'd hang around till about 5 o'clock at night when the wind would die down and we could get in another flight. So, we were in a flight, which means there were five of us, six of us, I guess, that flew together every day. Our instructor, who was the LSO, landing signals officer, who was the guy who would talk you down. So we were called Polecat Flight, and I was Polecat 1-3. But so what you have is when you come in to land on an aircraft carrier, you fly along the side of the aircraft carrier from front to back, and then you turn what's called the base leg, at which point you're looking at the carrier deck out your left side, and you pick up what's called the meatball, which is a red an orange light that reflects in a mirror. And as you turn onto the final straight in approach to the aircraft carrier, the ball will move up or down. If you're high, the ball goes high in the mirror. And if you go low, the ball goes, the reflection, which we call the ball, goes low and it finally turns red. And at that point, if it goes red, usually the LSO will have you wave off or you add power and keep going and go around again instead of trying to make the approach. So we did about, so we did that for about a month. We do that, go out there, and we'd do the practices, and then finally one day we do the real thing, and we all took off from NAS Ellis Field, which was, no, Softly Field, I'm sorry, in Pensacola, and we had an instructor who led us, and we were all in formation on him, and we flew out over the Gulf of Mexico till we saw this postage stamp down there, and that was the aircraft carrier. And then the instructor would end up, or the pilot who let us out would just go fly around in a pattern away from the aircraft carrier, and then we would end up shooting the patterns, and we did one touch and go. We came in the first time, we just did a low pass. We came in one at, you know, this is all one at a time. They lined up, and you come in and you do a low pass and go over the deck, and take off and go around again. So we did that. Then we did a touch and go where you bounce you touch the wheels on, and then we did five arrested landings where the hook is down and it catches the aircraft. And then then you raise the hook, they taxi you over, and these aircraft were so powerful, they didn't use catapults like they do now. You see the jets being launched off the carriers with the catapults, the steam catapults. You may have seen that. But these aircraft had such power that they could take off, that you just hold the brakes, put it to full military power, and take your feet off the brakes and go off the end of the deck, and the plane would keep going. It might sink a little bit off the nose, and then you could fly it out straight and then start to climb when you got your airspeed. Pretty neat, pretty exciting, and always a lot of incidents. A friend of mine, a guy I knew, went in the water. He was very lucky. He saw his airspeed. They say don't look at your airspeed, because you know, you see the airspeed as you're going out over the edge of the deck, and it's slower than the airplane will fly. You know it won't fly, but it's because there's a lag in the airspeed indicator. It's actually going faster than you think. But he thought it was. So he pulled the stick back to make it fly, which is the last thing you want to do because it makes it slower and it stalls. So he stalled and went off the side of the boat. He was lucky he went off the side because he didn't get hit by it. And they said he was out running along the top of the wing before it hit the water. They laughed. He was so not quite, but he was so fast at getting out of the getting out of the aircraft. He was very lucky. They say he was white as a sheet, and he was one of the few black aviators I knew in Pensacola at the time. So let's see what else. Then at night, we had what they call the debrief for the flight, and it was in a bar in Pensacola, and the flight instructor or your landing signals officer would be there, and it was like a party celebrating your success. And the most impressive thing was one of the flight instructors could do this trick where he would stand on his hands on a bar with a glass of beer on the bar in front of him, pick it up in his teeth, and drink the beer up while he was standing on his hands. Now, that was something I really remember.
I'm trying to picture how that works.
Yeah, I don't know how he did it, but he did it, and it was the thing he did at every one of these debriefs he did for the flights. And so after that, I ended up going to California, transitioned into the CH-46 helicopter, went home on leave with orders to Vietnam, Da Nang, Vietnam, and I got as far as Okinawa, which is island on the way, and my orders were canceled to Vietnam because by that time the Marine Corps is pulling out a lot of their units. And so I ended up being a maintenance test pilot in Okinawa and again in Japan, where I used to ferry helicopters from Okinawa that came from Vietnam and fly them up to Japan, which was about 5 hours over the ocean.
Oh, wow.
With, that was another thing. It was kind of exciting and fun because these aircraft had come out of Vietnam and they were really damaged and bullet holes in them and stuff. And the windows were all knocked out because the grunts used to break the windows out so they could shoot out the windows. And so we're flying these helicopters in the winter up over the Sea of Japan. The heaters were removed because they were extra weight. So they took them out in Vietnam, freezing with all we had inside was two huge tanks of fuel, extra fuel tanks, so we could make it to the very southern tip of Japan and where we could stop at a Japanese Air Force base and get fuel and then fly from there to Iwakuni, Japan, which was a Marine Corps air station in Japan, near Hiroshima, and we'd spend the night there, and then the next day we fly on to Atsugi Naval Air Station, which is south of Tokyo, sort of between Tokyo and Mount Fuji, and where they were overhauled. And then I was sent back as a test pilot assigned to the company to test the aircraft after they were rebuilt and accept them back into the Marine Corps to be set back for use. So that was
to be set back for use in Vietnam.
Pardon me?
To be used in Vietnam or somewhere or just elsewhere?
I think some went back to Vietnam, some went back to the States. Because I'm not sure exactly because it was being wound down by that time. But I think probably a lot of them went back to Vietnam. But it was incredible because you see these things, we'd fly them in, they looked like wrecks. The paint's all faded. There's little, you see all the patches. They patch them when they get shot. The skin, they rivet little pieces of metal over it. And then when they come out of the factory overhaul, they look like brand new aircraft.
Wow.
Yeah.
One thing that I was wondering about, so it's interesting that you were in this way, still interacting with what was going on in Vietnam, even though your orders to go to Vietnam got changed. I was wondering what it was like to go from expecting to be in the middle of that to then spending your time in Japan and like
right.
Okinawa. Because on your blog, checking my six, you said that you expect to fill 25.
Right.
So I'm just wondering what all that was.
Yeah. I mean, even though I was sent to Japan and other places, I was in a couple of little other squadrons for a short time in Okinawa before I went to Japan. And, so you never really knew. I mean, at any time they could have said, okay, we want to send you back. You could have gone to Vietnam for, a while. but it turned out I didn't. And I sort of felt guilty all my life because I didn't fly in combat. But that's sort of the way this war screwed everybody up in a way about guilt. The people who didn't go to Vietnam feel guilty because they didn't go to Vietnam and their buddies did. The guys who went to Vietnam didn't get hurt feel guilty because their buddy got wounded. The guys who got wounded feel guilty because their buddy got killed. It's, I think it created a whole guilt kind of trauma for a lot of people from this war. And I think it's lasted, you know, probably has lasted forever for a lot of these people. Because now, recently, my latest thing before this virus, I spent 6 years as a volunteer at the VA, Veterans Administration Hospital. I'm a driver, and I drive patients from up where I live in central Vermont down to the big hospital in White River, which is an hour. So once a week, I would go around and pick up four or five guys in the area and drive them down, wait for them while I had their appointments, and then bring them back to their homes. And I'll tell you, the Vietnam guys have had it tough. Their lives have been tough, and it might not be something you, and now they're still dying because of Agent Orange. I mean, that's what's so tragic, is the number of guys who left Vietnam unhurt, but are poisoned by Agent Orange. So, that's the end of my philosophy.
Did you feel that you or anyone else you were surrounded by was experiencing any form of that guilt, while you were a pilot? Or did it set in later?
I always sort of felt guilty or that I hadn't proven myself as a pilot. I mean, after I got back, I ended up in a job in Cherry Point, North Carolina, where I didn't get to fly. So I told the Marine Corps I wanted to get out. They had an early out program. And I was expecting a letter for them to let me out 3 months early. And then they called me up and they offered me a regular commission where they expect you to stay in forever. And, make a career of it. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I guess you didn't get my letter. I asked to get out. And I said, well, why do you want to get out? We want you to stay in. We think you're a good man. And I said, well, I want to fly. I want to be a pilot. I don't want to fly this desk down here. And the guy said, well, I'll call you back. I'll see if I can get you a job flying. And the only place I knew that anybody was flying at that time, because there was no money after the war. I mean, squadrons didn't have money to fly, basically. So the only place I thought I might get a job, was a flight instructor in Pensacola. And I didn't think I wanted that. But he called me back and he said, how would you like to go to HMX-1? And I said, what's that? And HMX-1 is the squadron that, among other things, flies the presidential helicopter, the one you see landing, and our present clown in chief making his speeches in front of to the press so they can't hear him. But anyway, I ended up in that squadron, which was really a neat squadron because in every other squadron, there's only one aircraft. I mean, one type of aircraft. So you fly the same model every day. At HMX, it has four different helicopters. Mm-hmm. So I was flying the CH-46. I was flying the Huey, UH-1. I flew the SH-3G, which was a military version of the presidential helicopter, which we used for training. And then I was a co-pilot on the presidential helicopter at times. So, and the best part of that place was I was the flight line officer on the non-White House aircraft side. They had two hangars, one for the top security helicopters and the ones that were regular helicopters. So I was the flight line officer, so I was responsible for all the mechanics on the flight line, and that was the neatest job. It was like being the father and teacher and motivator and protector of these young Marines who do phenomenal work on these aircraft, and became very close to these young Marines, and that was a very, very moving experience.
Yeah, I want to hear more about your work with Squadron One. Just to wrap up a little more about Japan, though, because the type of work you were doing changed a lot, and the setting changed a lot when you went from Japan and being close to Vietnam to then returning to the U.S. So after 1970, you were redirected to Japan, and I was wondering what it was like to be in post-occupation Japan, because, correct me if I'm wrong, it was mistaken from having any military force at that time. I was just wondering about, what it was like to interact with, if at all, people in Japan at that time.
Was it Japanese people?
Yeah, the Japanese people, especially in that, it was certainly post-war, but it was having an economic boom. I'm just wondering what it was, if you interacted at all with people there.
What was incredible to me was, what was this, 1970? And when did we bomb them? 25 years ago, we bombed North Vietnam, Japan, with two atomic bombs. And 25 years later, as an American in Japan, they were the friendliest, nicest people I've ever met. I mean, it's incredible. I was on a train, and I was trying to get back from Tokyo back to my base, and I needed to find out where my stop was. And I went up to this Japanese guy, say, Yamato, like point question mark with my hands and face. And he says, oh, sure, Yamato. It's two stops down. I'll let you know when it's time to get off. Perfect English. There was very good relationships between the Americans and the Japanese. At least I felt that way. Now it's gotten bad because the Japanese don't want Americans on Okinawa anymore. And we gave back Okinawa to Japan, and now they're trying to throw the Americans off the base, and the American troops there have been rapes and things like that of the Japanese women and stuff. So the things are different again now in Japan. In Okinawa, I think Japan is probably fine. So mechanics who were Japanese who worked on the aircraft were so dedicated and working. And when you go out to do a test flight, nobody was allowed in the aircraft. None of them were. So it would just be me as a pilot with no co-pilot and a mechanic from the Marine Corps, and we'd do the test flights. And if something went wrong, the Japanese guys would go crazy. They'd be so upset and embarrassed and all that. Where the difference was, 2 years later, in the United States, I was with a co-pilot on a flight. We took a helicopter from Quantico out to North Island, California, for overhaul. And we were supposed to pick up one that had been overhauled by Americans in California, and we're going to the pre-flight of the one that's all fixed and we're supposed to take out, and the pilot says, this transmission mount's cracked. You could see it from inside the aircraft. I mean, that the whole helicopter could come apart. And the guy who was in charge of the maintenance place there, this was a Friday afternoon, so of course he wanted to go home. He said, well, that wasn't on the contract. So instead of fixing it so the airplane was safe to fly, they hadn't done anything. They didn't care. It's just, it was a whole different type of mentality between the Japanese and, you know, these American union workers back then. I remember when I was in Japan, the movie Tora 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 was showing in Tokyo, and I thought about going just to see it. You know, the movie, it was about the bombing of Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. American movie was showing in Tokyo. I was going to go watch it, but I didn't go. I thought it would have been very interesting to watch the people in Japan as they watched that movie, but I did not do that.
Why didn't you go?
I don't know. That was a long time ago. probably because I just couldn't get to Tokyo to do it at the time or something. It was a long way up from where I was.
And did you have any feelings of... So they were generally very friendly, but did you have any feelings about... in some way representing the U.S., did you feel like that? Or do you just feel like you were there as a, you know, as a pilot, as a member of the Marine Corps? Like, did you feel sort of any sense of national identity coming with you?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I would always try to be not the ugly American wherever I went because of my background and respectful. But I wasn't around that many people because I lived on base and I didn't travel around that much just because of the logistics of everything. So there was another pilot with me, but his wife came over to Japan, and they ended up renting I never went there, a tiny little house in Japan, and I just said, why don't you just go do whatever you want, and I did all the flying while he and his wife lived in Japan for 3 months.
You were just like, you can go ahead and...
Yeah, you know. I mean, I didn't have anything to do. I was flying. If I was flying, that was great. There wasn't much else to do. I'd just sit around and wait and on base because I couldn't just... So I say, Will, why don't you go out and just... So I did all the flying. It was kind of neat, actually, because there wasn't that much flying to do, so I had to do it, if there was. And there was a time, I didn't mention that before I got the test pilot job up there, I was attached to a detachment of three CH-46 helicopters that were based at Atsugi that provided helicopter support to a Marine artillery base, which is at the base of Mount Fuji, Camp Fuji. And we supplied them with medevac helicopter support or anything they needed a helicopter for. So I got to fly around a lot of Mount Fuji area and saw a good bit of that part of Japan from the cockpit.
Yeah, I mean, you seem to really, really like flying. But I bet being, yeah, just like... Did you enjoy flying while you were actually doing it?
Oh, yeah. I enjoyed flying. It took, I mean, I had a hard time getting through flight school, and because I was so stressed by trying to do well. I mean, a lot of times I'd go out, get ready for a flight before the instructor would come out, I'd puke behind the aircraft because I was a little nervous. And finally, at the very end of my flight training, we did the last thing after the carrier qual. You go into a helicopter squad, and then it's a quick thing. They just transition you into a helicopter for a while. And I have this old retired Navy commander who they hired back as an instructor. And he said to me, "Hale, you are one of the most natural pilots I've ever known, but you're too tense." He said, you ought to take 2 shots of scotch before every flight and you'll be the best. So finally, as I got more and more experience and I became more comfortable, it became almost like second nature to fly the helicopter, the CH-46, the one I flew so much. I mean, when I first flew it to hover, you have to concentrate to every muscle and nerve and sensory perception, looking out the windows to hover. Because, you know, the thing wants to go up and down, it wants to go left and right, it wants to go front and back. So hovering is very difficult. And it used to be, take all that. But by the time I was a test pilot, I could hover without even looking out of the aircraft. I could lean over looking at an instrument like 3 inches away so I could read exactly what it was. And the helicopter would stay rock solid just because the sense was there. And anyway, I don't know where I was going with that, but. Are you there? Yeah.
I am. Yeah.
There was a story. One time we, a friend of mine, a co-pilot and I, had to go up to the artillery range of Mount Fuji to pick up a fighter pilot. He was a F-4 Phantom fighter pilot, Marine, who was at the time working as a forward air controller. They're with the grunts, and they call in airstrikes, and they use pilots to do it. And he had the weekend off, so we went up to pick him up to bring him down to Yokosuka near Tokyo so he could have a weekend off. And he made the comment. He said, this is going to be a bleeper maybe. He said, you know, flying a helicopter is kind of like masturbating. It's fun, but you don't want to tell your friends you do it. So, okay, let's try this. So we went and landed at Tsuki and landed on a helicopter pad. I got out of the seat, sat in the back, and we let the big hotshot fighter pilot get in the cockpit. And, okay, you got it. Let's see you hover. After bouncing around and crashing and banging around for a while, he said, okay, I got it. It's not that easy.
Oh my gosh. it sounds, do you feel like of places that you worked either in Okinawa or the second station in Japan, do you feel like you, despite there not being that many people, maintained relationships or, like, you know, how was it socially?
There was about 10 pilots there. There was a group with the Mount Fuji group, so there were 6 pilots for that, and then I was there. So there was about 8 pilots, and then there was a naval air station, so there were Navy pilots, and the Navy people had their families there, where the Marines were just in and out, you know. The Navy was there for a long time. But I didn't maintain, I mean, I've been in touch with some of the people, but not much from there. I'm still in touch almost a couple times a week with one of the guys I went through carrier quals with, the pole cap flight guy, one of those guys, and I keep in touch with him all the time. But I'm not too much in touch with other people. Time and distance.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, you moved a lot. So then you, when was it that you went back to the U.S.? Is that what you did directly after Japan?
Yes. I went to North Carolina for almost a year until they sent me up to Quantico to be at HMX 1. And I was there, and I got married there, and I ended up resigning my commission in 1975, and I got out of the Marine Corps.
So Marine Helicopter Squadron 1, you talked about joining that a little bit. And on your blog that I've mentioned, you said, when I checked into the squadron on April 17th, 1972, I was the youngest and most junior officer, first lieutenant on board. What was that like to be junior, but to be, you know, working with, a very uniquely oriented, squadron?
Yeah. And when I first got there, I thought, why am I here? I mean, I remember I walked into the operations officer and turned in my logbook, and he looked at it and he said, well, how come you haven't been flying for a year? And I said, because I explained it. And he said, and I finally said, look, if you don't want me here, if I don't have enough hours, let me out. Just call headquarters and let me get out like I really wanted to. He said, oh, no, lighten up. So I didn't have enough hours to fly in the presidential helicopter. And that's what they want you there for, to be a co-pilot on the alert aircraft. They have three helicopters that were on alert back then, just across the river from the White House in Anacostia. So they had three aircraft that are on alert, ready to launch in minutes. So they'd like to have a lot of co-pilots to do that. So they wanted to get me enough hours so I could do that. So I got to fly so much. Any mission they had, the CH-46 or anything else, I got to fly. That was great. I was flying all the time. And finally got enough hours so I could start flying on the presidential helicopters, and then they do what's called the saturation tour, where the new pilots go up and they spend 3 days on, 3 days off for a month on the alert with the alert group up in Anacostia, and they would have drills. I mean, this was just a hangar. We had an ice ready room and a TV. They had a wood shop. They had all sorts of stuff you could do just to kill the time. And every crew of the three crews that were there would take their helicopter out one at a time and fly it around for an hour just to keep it, you know, oil running. Just like anything, you have to keep it running well to run it. So we'd fly for an hour, come back. The White House would send us some movies to watch. We'd watch a movie. and then we'd have these drills. I mean, picture this. You're sound asleep in this room with six pilots, six guys, and all of a sudden the lights go on, the sirens go off, and then you hear this. This is the White House. Execute. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Whatever it was. And and the helicopters are in the hangar, but they're attached to the tow trackers. So what we would do was run and either beat the helicopter on the way out or jump in it on the flight line. And you'd be from sound asleep to maybe 6 minutes, 7 minutes flying over the tidal basin at night.
Wow.
And it was pretty challenging because the aircraft has what's called stabilization assistance, which electronics helps the aircraft know if it's going frontwards or backwards. In fact, it helps it control itself. And that doesn't really come online for about 5 minutes. So you're making the takeoff without that. So it's like flying a football until the SAS came on, and then you fly, and we do different things, go different places. And the plan was one helicopter would go to the Pentagon, one would go to the Capitol, and one would go to the White House and pick up certain people and take them different places.
You know, so this was during Nixon's presidency, right? That
yes.
You were, did you have any personal experiences with him or, or the White House?
Not really. I mean, I flew with him. I flew President Nixon back from Camp David. I was a co-pilot on the night that he fired Archibald Cox. You know, the history of that is he was the special prosecutor investigating Nixon, and he fired him. You know, they called it the Midnight Massacre or something.
Yeah.
I flew him back that night. Like when the aircraft landed and dropped him off or picked him up, the co-pilot would have the controls of the aircraft, you know, and the pilot would, aircraft commander would always shake the, you know, would lean over, or the president would lean in and thank him, shake his hand. I think he may have patted me on the shoulder once. But, so I flew him, I flew Gromyko from Russia when he was visiting with the president, and in the non-presidential lineup, I flew vice presidents and all sorts of admirals and high mucky mucks, just as a best pilot. It was pretty fun. I mean, one interesting fun time was had to pick up some Navy admirals at the Pentagon, picked them up at the Pentagon helicopter pad, and flew them up to the Naval Academy in Annapolis, and landed on the football field. And we knew we were going to have to wait for them for a few hours. So they were getting out. We shut down the aircraft. And, you know, we figured we'd just be lying around under the aircraft in the shade or hanging out waiting for them. And the admiral said, "Hey, Captain, what are you doing? What are you going to do while we were waiting?" I said, "Let's just wait for you here." He said, "No, you guys come with us. This is going to be fun." And the Navy was testing a new gunboat that a Boeing had built for them. It was a hydrofoil. You know, it was like a 60-foot long boat. Maybe bigger, gunboat that, you know, at high speed, it lets out those wings down onto the water and it picks up and flies on the water. So they invited us along, so we got to go for a ride in that. We got this drive. It was pretty neat.
That was pretty neat.
Yeah, it was called the Tuckum Carry, and I guess it never... And they never developed them any further.
Yeah.
So what was nice about, or interesting about the HMX squadron, that one, is that one day you could be flying the president, the next day you could be flying in the woods with the students from the Marine Officers Basic School doing combat inserts and training missions for them, with them. Over on a Saturday, we might take up the members of the Quantico Skydiving Club and take them up so they can skydive out of the aircraft. So it was very varied. Did some test hops, did some testing at the Navy test test labs at Dahlgren, we used to, a friend of mine and I, another pilot and I had this duty, we'd go down once a week with one of our CH-46 helicopters, and these engineers would get in and they'd hang some stuff on the side of the aircraft and they'd say, okay, fly toward that island, don't look back, because this thing could hurt your eyes, whatever it was. And so we did this for about, I don't know, six, seven weeks. And finally said, okay, guys, we got it. We got exactly what we need. And it turns out they were developing the laser-guided bomb system. So it was soon, I'm not sure this is true, but I sort of think it was soon after that that we were able to take out some bridges in North Vietnam. They've been trying to bomb for years and never been able to hit. And it was the beginning of the use of the laser bombs.
Wow.
Okay. Pardon?
Are you again?
Well, my last real story, I think, is the most meaningful mission I ever got to fly wasn't flying to the president or any other of those guys. Was when the prisoners of war came back from Vietnam, they each were flown by the Air Force into from the Philippines to different bases in the United States, whether it be either families or whatever. So one night I was sent up to Andrews Air Force Base to pick up somebody, and it turns out his name was Ray Alcorn, Naval Commander, he was lieutenant when he got shot down. So Ray Alcorn was a Navy A-4 pilot, who got shot down like on his, I don't know, 10th mission, and spent over 7 years in prison camp in Vietnam. So we got to fly up to Andrews Air Force Base, where I got off the big jet from the Philippines, and he got on our plane or helicopter. We shook his hand and I gave him my flight jacket because he was cold, and we had a little VIP chair seat sit in the back of the CH-46 by the window so you could see, and he was to go to Bethesda Hospital where his family was and where they'd be going over him physically for a while. So I took off out of this isn't I, it's we, the crew. So I took off out of Andrews, needing to go to Bethesda Hospital, which is normally you do down on helicopter routes, which are low above the water of the Potomac or Anacostia River, wherever you're going. They have these different helicopter routes. So they stays under the jet traffic going into Andrews and going into Washington National Airport. And it keeps you away from all the restricted zones like the White House in Washington. Took off, called Washington Tower, and said, Washington Tower, this is Nighthawk 19, and we're off of Andrews Air Force Base with Commander Alcorn on board. The commander is just coming home from 7 years in Hanoi, Hilton, and we need to go to Andrews. And they said, Nighthawk 19, from the voice at Washington Tower, welcome the commander home, and you can go wherever you want across Washington tonight. So I was able to fly the helicopter over Washington, which was fully lit up on a clear night, skirting around the White House, and then over Washington into a Bethesda Hospital where I thought it was his wife and child, but it was his sister and niece. We're waiting for him. And by this time, I'm freaking crying. It was the most moving experience of my life. And I've thought about this man and this event probably monthly for the last 20 years. And the weird thing was I had forgotten his name. And it really bothered me because I wanted to know what happened to him. But about a year ago, I was going through some letters that my father left that I had written when I was in high school and college and Marines. And I found a letter describing that night, and it had his name, Ray Alcorn. So I tracked him down, and I actually spoke to him. And he remembers that night as the point where his life changed, the welcome home, the flight over Washington. And it was an important thing to him. It was an important thing to me. Unfortunately, he recently, in the last couple of months, passed away from cancer. So that's that story, which to me was pretty important.
What was it like to find out that that was also a pivotal, memorable time for him, given that you'd thought about it monthly for the last 45 years?
Yeah, I mean, it meant a lot that it meant a lot to him. Because, I mean, he ended up doing a lot of things. He was in the Navy a long time after that. And the fact that he remembered that night like he did, how important it was. The way I found out more about him was there's a woman in North Carolina, the town he lives in, who works for a newspaper who decided to write articles about, or do what you're doing, but short interviews with each of the veterans she could find around that area. And she wrote an article in her local paper weekly for months, or a year, I think. And she met Ray, and she wrote the article about Ray. And that's how I basically tracked him down, was through her. And since then, she and I have been in touch, and she wrote an article about Ray for this book she wrote, which is called Welcome Home, Brother. And
Welcome Home, Brother?
Yes.
I'm taking notes. Yeah, okay.
And Welcome Home, Brother, and it's written by, her name is Michael Robertson, and so she's written that, and she's written the article about Ray, and then she did an addendum attached to Ray's about my experience with Ray, and so it's kind of neat.
What kinds of things did she say about your experience with Ray?
Basically, she told about the flight that I just talked to you about.
So that was Ray was released in 1973. You continued to work in the Marine Corps until 1975. And why 1975 did you transition out of your work as a pilot?
I got married in 74 to a woman who I met at the squadron. She was a clerk at the squadron, actually. She's a local girl from Spotsylvania, Virginia, Fredericksburg area. And we got married, and I adopted her young son. And it looked like if when my next orders out of HMX would have probably been to go aboard a carrier, a helicopter ship, for a year on a company tour. And I also felt that I'd seen a lot of my friends get passed over for major. And if you don't make major in 20 years, as a regular officer, they throw you out and you get nothing, no retirement. So you could be in 19 years, not make major, and you're done, and you have nothing for the 20 years. So I figured, wow, I don't even have any combat time. how am I going to make it? But so we decided to resign, and we moved to New Hampshire. We lived in Concord until I found a job, and I ended up finding a job at Mary Hitchcock Hospital in Hanover.
Yeah.
Because the director of the hospital was a former Army colonel who was a head of ROTC at Dartmouth when I was there, and he was my advisor at Dartmouth. I went up just to visit with him, and he ended up finding me. He had a job opening that worked, and I ended up taking a job and ended up working there for about 12 years at Dartmouth, at the hospital, which was in Hanover at the time.
And before, what did you do in that job?
The title was Assistant Director of Communications and Transportation. So I was responsible for all the telephone systems, radio systems, and as assistant director. And also I was responsible for the orderlies who do all the patient movement, transporting patients within the hospital. And, so it was interesting. It was good. I had a boss who was a woman who was not very well, so I ended up she'd be gone for months at a time, and I would run the place, and then when she came back, it would be difficult. And finally, I found out there was a job opening at the state of Vermont for a director of telecommunications for the state, and I got that job and worked there for 21 years.
Wow. What was that experience like, working there for 21 years?
At first it was really good because you work for political appointees, and the first ones I worked for were really good, and they let people who knew what they were doing do their job. So I did a whole lot of great stuff when I first got there. I got contracts with home companies that never had, so saved the state billions of dollars right off. And but politics came in, and you got more and more incompetent leaders responsible to work. You have to work for who are, all they want to do is make a name for themselves. So I basically retired early because I couldn't stand my position in there. And so it's too bad, I think. And I think that's a problem with politics. But I don't think I want to go there anymore.
Yeah. Well, so what about being back in the area of Vermont and New Hampshire? Because you spent a significant amount of time there, like going to Dartmouth.
Yeah.
What was that like to be back?
My wife Sharon and I were going up to visit my father, who was at the time he was president of Linden State College by this time, up in northern Vermont, and we were going to visit him, and then I was going to come back down, and we were going to visit my mother because they got divorced in Middlebury. So we were driving along the interstate. You probably know the spot. When you come from Concord to Hanover, you come up over that hill, there's that really neat rest area in New Hampshire that looks out over the mountains and everything. And it was a beautiful snowy day, and my wife and I talked at that time. We said, it's time to get out and move to Vermont or New Hampshire. And so we did. So my life never was by a plan. It's sort of like a lot of lives, I think. Just things happen, and you do things because you have to, or it's convenient at the time. It's not like I ever sat down and decided, this is what I want to be when I grow up.
I remember earlier you mentioned that commitment to service that you inherited from your father, sort of like in an unspoken way. Did you feel like you continue still to have that, even if not in the form of, working with the Marine Corps?
I feel that way, and it's not that I do that much now. I mean, there was the VA drive me into that because it was helping people that needed help. I don't think I'll be doing that again because they've shut it down because of the coronavirus, and I don't think I'll be driving anymore, even when they do start it up, because I'm so vulnerable to it. And but I will be doing all the scheduling for it, as I always have also. So I'll be continuing to do that. I think because of the way I am, because of my dad and all, even though I don't do the things I would wish I could do, I mean, and the way I feel about what's happening to this country and such is so disturbing to me today.
Yeah.
And,
what have your thoughts been recently? Because, we're in 2020, we're not even halfway through it. And a lot of horrifying things have happened between the pandemic and this recently started or accelerated at least movement away from racism, frankly.
Yes. Yeah. It is shameful. And I'm sort of ashamed of myself in a way, because I don't think before the last murder in Minneapolis that I really, really got it, what it was like to be a black man today. I didn't get the fear and the stuff. I always cared about the black movement and everything like that, but I don't think I realized. I think a lot of people probably didn't really quite realize how bad their lives have been. And you start to think about it, it's been 400 years where this country has treated human beings worse than they treat an animal. And and then you have a president who has no empathy, no understanding, no intelligence, and no leadership to help bring the country together. I think we're at a really serious time. We've been in a serious time for the last 3 years. I'm hoping that this new Black Lives Movement and the realization of so many people that the president is completely incompetent will change, get a new president, and hopefully we can start bring this country back to where it should be, or make it where it should be, even though it maybe never have actually been what we hoped for.
Yeah, it's tough to say where, if there is a state that we should revert to, or if it's going to have to be a completely new, if everything's going to have to be completely different, like our system.
I think it's
going
to be different. I think it's going to have to be different, because you look back, even though I wasn't aware of it, racism was much worse, and it still is, and it's not going to go away. I mean, some people will never change, but their children are changing. So hopefully when the people like me die off, our kids will bring the country will be a better place. It's going to be up to kids like you, my daughter, and but I think this is a time that could save this country. But I don't think that many of my ilk, my age group, are going to be helped.
Does any of this make you think back to, the Vietnam era, and then specifically you just mentioned racism, which has come up a couple times, mentioned some on Dartmouth campus when you attended?
Say again? I'm sorry.
Does anything that's happening right now make you think of things from the 60s and the 70s that you experienced or witnessed, because you just mentioned racism?
Yeah. I think I was out of the country. Well, there was Rodney King and all those riots back then.
No.
I don't think it was done. It wasn't positive like it is today, the protests. And it was a tough time. I mean, when I was in the Marine Corps in Okinawa, the Black Panthers were really strong. And like when I was a squadron duty officer in Okinawa, they had us carry pistols. It wasn't because we were worried about the enemy. It was because the Black Panthers were trying to kill white officers and things like that. So I don't know. It seems that now, finally, the real ability for people to communicate has really come forward. I mean, look at those protests with the Black kids, the white kids, old and young, police going on their knee, respect. But you do have the deep-seated racism still. You can see it in some of the cops. You can see it in a lot. And I think we're going to see more of it as this Black Lives Matters movement proceeds. I think it's going to wake up a counter movement. I mean, I was just reading an article today about the Indian NASCAR, the redneck racing. No.
Yeah.
But I mean, they've banned the Confederate flag from all NASCAR events. Now that's going to be really interesting. Because these good old Southern boys, they pretend it has nothing to do with racism. And maybe a lot of them it doesn't. But why are we celebrating a flag of a country that, or an organization that the United States defeated because of racism? I mean, why do we have statues to Robert E. Lee? Why do we name army bases after generals in the Confederacy? We beat them. The only reason those statues and things are there is because after the Civil War in the early 90s, it was a way for the white people to continue their domination of the Black by putting up a big statue of some Southern general on a horse.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think we're straying.
Yeah, it's okay. It had me thinking about the George Wallace who visited Dartmouth.
Yes.
And pardon me. When you went there, he was well remembered for being a segregationist, and only a couple days ago citizens in Alabama began asking for his name to be, or demanding that it be taken off this tunnel that's named after him, the George Wallace Tunnel. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And he's, you know, obviously of a different era completely than the Confederacy, but, mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
It is.
But yeah.
Yes.
No, I wanted to get your perspective on that because I think a lot of things unfolded in that era, when you were, in the Marine Corps and when you were in college that are, you know, coming into a different light right now. So
that's true. And I think back in that era, I always said, well, why take down the statues? You know, that's history. But you know, when you study it, you really realize those statues were built way after the war at a time. I guess it was, I'm not that good at American history now, but after the Jim Crow thing, and it was just another way to dominate, and dominate, that's a good word, Mr. President. We can dominate.
is there anything else that you want to talk about related to Dartmouth, to Vietnam, the Marine Corps, or anything else that you've been thinking about before I end the interview, if you have anything you want to say?
I think I have often thought what I would do if I was still a presidential helicopter squad pilot today.
Yeah.
With this president, I have fantasies, but I really hope I would have had the courage just to say, I will not fly this guy. Get me out of here. But there's other things I could have done if I did. But no. I felt like I could have spoken to him. Let's leave it at that. Okay?
Yeah, we should leave it at that. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today and, doing it in these crazy conditions where we're speaking to each other on the phone. You have really, really interesting perspectives, and, thank you.
Well, you're welcome, and I hope it was interesting and